Christianity.
Problem with Christianity.
My problem with Christianity is they just want to take the fun out of everything.
The problem with Christianity is
the problem with Christianity is that I know Christians that don't live out what they say.
Is that so judgmental towards sexual orientation.
Allow death and destruction and war in our world.
Would a loving God really send that many people to hell?
It's no different than Greek
mythology. The problem with Christianity is you can't scientifically
prove. How do you know God's real?
How do you know God's real?
Well, good morning, everybody. Good to see you today. My name is Matt. I'm one of the pastors here. And if you are a guest with us this morning, I always stand right out at the door after our service. And I would love to just shake your hand and meet you, kind of connect a name and a face, that kind of thing. That's certainly something that's important to me. And I hope that I can make myself available to you because we're all about getting to know people here, all about helping people to connect within community. So, man, please make sure you stop by and at least give me a chance to greet you. The other thing I want to say really quick before we get underway is this is the first service, and usually there's a certain numerical value in the first service, but I think it's going to be a little higher today than normal in first service because there's a 10 a.m. Seahawks game, all right? And here I need to remind people, some of us are recording this, all right? And some of us do not want to know any updates, any scores. Have you seen? Have you heard? Do you know? Don't come to me at the door and be like, I don't want to see that. I don't want you to come to the door and be like, I don't want to see that. I want nothing. So I say this because every single time somebody comes to me and says, here's my phone. Look, don't do that. All right. So Pastor Matt, when he goes home, he needs to decompress. And the best way to do that is to get nervous about his team. All right. But to do so completely unscathed, knowing what's going on. So, love me. Please love me. And don't tell me anything today as you see me at the door. And I know we're just going to barely be getting underway, but I still don't want to know. All right. So is that enough blanket statements there? I think it is. Okay. With that then, I'm going to go ahead and pray so we can get right to business with what actually matters, which is not Seahawks, I know, but actually Jesus, which is very important. So let's go ahead and pray together. Jesus, I thank you for today. And I thank you for the opportunity to deal with this particular topic. And so asking for a very special measure of your grace and your spirit to guide me, to guide my words, and to give us a sense of good conversations and difficult topics. And so I just ask for a very, very special favor from you today. And we just thank you for the opportunity we have to do this in your perfect and good name. Amen. So most of us in this room, with probably very rare exception, we were bred, born, and raised in a very consumer-driven, American independence, kind of free market capitalistic kind of spirit or society. And from that, we are used to having certain things a certain way. Basically, we like to be able to receive as individuals that which we are most interested in the way that we are interested in it. In other words, we like customization. We like having options. We like being able to build things to suit what we prefer, right? So in this sense, we're kind of a Chipotle culture, right? We love to go through the line at Chipotle and be like, I want a bowl. No, I want a burrito. No, I want tacos. I want beef. No, I want chicken. No, I want beans. I want white rice. I want brown rice. We like to be able to put together the palette of what it is we like and desire, right? That's pretty normal to us as Americans. The problem or the challenge that may be in there then is that when we come up against something that is kind of narrow, or it seems closed-minded, or it seems rigid, or you don't have options, it's a one-size-fits-all, it has this sense of exclusivity behind it, the velvet rope that says, no, it's VIP only, it's only a certain group, a certain way, certain conditions. We tend to struggle with that. We're slightly repulsed by the notion. We are bothered by the fact that there are some things that claim to be absolute. And one of the places probably most Americans tend to struggle with this is in the realm of faith or religion, right? As soon as a religion rolls in and says, our way is the only way and all other ways are deficient, they're all dead ends, we get this thing, this thing in our chest that's kind of like, oh man, I don't like that tone at all. And because of all of that, it sets us up today for one of the unique challenges when it comes to Christianity. When people look at Christianity, they have a lot of criticisms, a lot of concerns. But one of the biggest things is they say the problem with Christianity is its exclusivity. That it says its faith is the only legitimate faith in the world. That is a big problem for people. And so that's what we're going to be tackling today. And so as we do so, I want to invite you, if you have our app, you can open up the app now. We've got notes that you can follow along in there today, so that's something. And then the other thing I keep reminding throughout the series is we're not going to be able to deal with everything. I can't answer every question as I do this particular talk. And so we have a number up here, and you can text in any question you want, right? You can say, well, what about those who never hear? Or, you know, whatever your question might be today, you can text that in, and then I will go in tomorrow. I will record that for our podcast, and then that will go live on Tuesday, and we'll seek to try to unpack some extension questions that people might have, all right? So kind of doing it that way. Also, I just want to say really quick is if you're not a Christian and you're visiting with us today, or you're not a Christian and you're watching online, we are really, again, thankful that you're checking this out and that you are, as I keep saying, open-minded enough to interact, to dialogue, to investigate what it is that Christians believe. And I hope that we do a decent job of trying to be sincere and clear with what it is Christians tend to believe as far as kind of historically and globally and that kind of thing. So that's our heart behind this whole deal. Now, I want to start off on something kind of just ripping the can open right off the bat. And I want to deal with an assumption that some people may have, all right? Some people in this room or some people watching may have the assumption that Christians think that Jesus is the only way to heaven. There's an assumption that some people have that say Christians think that it's the cross and resurrection that are the only instruments and tools that get you into heaven and get you to God. I want to say right now, if that is your assumption, I want you to retire that assumption because that is a concrete fact, all right? What I mean by that is, in fact, that is what Christians believe. I'm done. We can pray and I'll go to Ixtapa now. We can catch the game, right? So, I want to clear that up. I'm not going to try to take away from that, right? My goals right now, already the tensions are up. He said it. All right, so, but I want to be clear. I don't want to sugarcoat that. I don't want to try to give you a price tag switch and say Christians don't believe that fundamentally. They do. But I think in there are some thoughts and ideas and tone that we need to address. I think there's some things that miscommunicate that idea, and I think there's some things that rightly communicate that idea, and I think there's some other things in the mix that we should probably spend some time on to understand really what Christians mean in relationship to the idea that they believe that what they believe is the way, because kind of historically and globally, that has been true. Now, I want to start someplace a little different. I want to start with Christianity. I want to start outside of some ideas of faith altogether, and I just want to deal with the fact of all exclusivity. Everything that claims to be exclusive, everything that claims to have sort of this velvet rope of VIP, right? And so we're going to start in your notes with number one, in general. In general, and this is just my personal opinion here, but I find exclusivity to be both universal and helpful. I think it's universal, and I think it's helpful. So let me give you some examples of the universal nature of people who are exclusive. I think about my atheist friends who say all religion is fake. I think about my pluralist friends who say all religions are true. So one group says they're all fake, the other says they're all true, right? I think about other people like agnostics who say, well, no one can actually know what's true or false. And then I think of pretty much every single global religion that says our way is the only way, the right way, or the true way. In short, what we see is every one of those groups, you ready? They're exclusive. They all have exclusive belief. They all have a deep-seated conviction that the way they see the world is accurate. And see, this is where I just want to be clear. I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for the fact that people have enough conviction to take what they believe and state it as a fact. I think that's a healthy place to be. That's gumption, man. I want more gumption in our world where they go, this is what I really believe. Now, I don't mean you say it like a jerk or a punk or a thug or whatever. I don't mean it that way. We should be very generous and gracious and compassionate in our convictions, but I think that's a healthy thing. Now, at the same time, here's what I also want to say. I think sometimes there are people that look at Christianity and they say, oh, see, it's just so full of itself. It's so closed-minded. It's so narrow. And they kind of put this moniker on Christianity when that's true to a lot of other things in life as well. And I think we should remove that kind of accusation that calls people closed-minded simply because they believe what they believe with determination. Because, again, that's everybody. And again, not just in the realm of atheism or agnosticism or whatever else, just all kinds of things in life. There's this sense in which groups come to conclusions that say our way is the only way. For example, my friends, the vegans, their way is the only way for them. And if I was to come in one day and I'm like, hey, I want to join your vegan group. I want to be a vegan, except when I'm eating steak. They're going to be like, then you don't want to be a vegan, bro. Well, I do, except when I'm eating steak. Other than that, I'll be, well, and chicken. But other than that, and fish. But other than that, I'll be a vegan. They say, no, we're exclusive, man. It's either you're all in or you're all out on being a vegan. That's exclusive. And I think that's helpful, right? Or, for example, we have some in this room that are Democrats and some in this room that are Republicans. And there are convictions behind that, and that is a grouping, and in those groupings, there is a sense of exclusivity. I don't meet a lot of Democrats who are like, I really have a strong conviction about small government, right? I don't meet Republicans who say, I have a big, big conviction about a huge bloated government. I think that would make everything work awesome, because they land in a certain category with certain beliefs and ideas, and they're exclusive. So there are tons of examples where I think more often than not, we believe in exclusivity, not the absence of. Even the most inclusive groups in American society. You think about in your mind those groups that are known for their message of being inclusive are so with exclusive ideas behind it. And as soon as you don't hold to those exclusive ideas of inclusivity, you're not inclusive, right? So all of this is true. So we shouldn't start pointing the fingers, oh, they're this, when everybody's that. But as I said earlier, I also think it's helpful. I think it's helpful when groups state what they believe and why they believe it. Here's our rule book, and here's our code of conduct, and here's our standards, and here's our expectations, and here's what it means to belong, and this is true for the insider, and this is true for the outsider. That is immensely helpful because I want to know what I'm getting into from the get-go. Or here's another one. I want you to think about this. I think it's important that we know how to truly articulate what some other group believes and how they behave based on what they believe. So that we don't just set up straw men and say, oh, well, what they believe and how they behave is the most extreme, outlandish version. And we try to pretend like that is the whole of that group. Now, I think it's good for us to be open-minded enough to understand other cultures, other societies, other visions for the world, and be able to say, this is what they really believe, this is how the majority of them behave, and therefore I have a better understanding. That's helpful. I think that's why. So let's say, for example, I decide I'm going to join a soccer club. See, it's good from the outset to know what it's all about. So really, like it is, right? It's if I don't, I'm in big trouble. So I sit down with them. They go, okay, we are a global sport. And I go, cool, it's all over the globe. It's got stuff everywhere. There are rules for soccer. And then in our club, there's a code of conduct that we ask everybody to abide by. And then we ask everybody to be at practice and to be at matches and to be a part of tournaments and to wear the jersey and to be a team and understand our plays and understand how we err on offense and defense and that kind of thing. And to have all of that outlined in advance is very helpful so that I know if I'm joining the club, that I know what's expected, right? Wouldn't it be stupid if I'm like, I join, and then I get in there, and I go, okay, but here's the thing, though. I don't think it's very inclusive that I can't use my hands unless I'm the goalie. I think it would be fair if everybody could use their hands. Right? And I can't make every practice, but I want to be in every match because, again, I want to be noticed, but I don't want to always put in the time. But, you know, that would be really fair as well. And then our jerseys are yellow. I'm a winter, all right? I'm going with blue, all right? So pretty soon, if I keep trying to tamper with soccer and the club and the rules and the code of conduct and the practice, and everybody's trying to do the same, then pretty soon you don't have soccer. You just have that version that five-year-olds play of soccer, right? And it's just it'd be madness, right? This is what I'm getting at. This mythology that says exclusive is bad is maybe a broken thought. Perhaps exclusive is not only universal and everybody does it, but it's helpful and it can be good because it defines the parameters of a group. Beliefs and behaviors, and we can understand that and one another and then hopefully have a little bit more compassion and empathy and relationship even in the differences. It's better for me not to join the soccer club than to try to join and then redefine everything, but to go, but that's what soccer is all about. That's what it believes. That's what it does. I want to use my hands, so I play football. That's what I do. You know, like, whatever it is. But exclusive is universal, and I think exclusive is helpful. And it's something that we shouldn't start tampering with. And so the same is going to be then true with what I'm trying to articulate today about Christianity. Christianity is an exclusive faith. It is. And we're going to look at this with number two in your notes. Number two is this. Christianity is exclusive because its founder said he is the only way. Now, I want to acknowledge something here. And this goes back maybe 15 years ago, so I think the numbers are even higher. But like 15 years ago, 52% of church-going, Bible-believing Christians said they did not believe Jesus was the only way. So Bible-believing, church-going Christians, a slight majority said, this is our way. We don't believe it's the only way. And I believe that most Christians said that, not because not deep down inside they don't maybe believe that it is the only way, but because, again, we are all a part of this culture that is repelled by the notion of the velvet rope. That there would be an exclusive thing that only some people pass and other people don't, and this is going to be the way that happens. And so we don't want to sound arrogant. We don't want to sound callous and cold. We don't want to sound like those crazy people that we see on the news that sound that way. And so we go, I don't know, because I don't want to sound too bad. But here's the thing I want to say to us as Christians. If Jesus is our founder, right, we kind of anchor on that, and if Jesus' vision for life is the vision that we hold as a vision for life, and if we look at this book and the ancient documents that are inside these leather bindings, and from that we go, I trust those words. When Jesus says, love your neighbor, and when Jesus says, love your enemy, and when Jesus says, do good to others, and when Jesus says, help the poor, and when Jesus says all these things, and I believe those things, I also believe all the other things that maybe he says that is uncomfortable, and from that, we have to then own the fact that Jesus didn't leave us with a lot of options. If we're banking on him, now if we're not, that's a different thing, but if we're banking on him, we have to own the fact that Jesus didn't leave us a lot of option when it comes to the fact that he communicated himself to be exclusive. And John, this ancient document recording the history of Jesus's life, he said this. It says, for God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. Whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe is condemned already because he has not believed in the name of the only Son of God. See, Jesus just says it outright, right? In John 14:6, a little bit later, he says, I am the way and the truth and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me. See, this is where I go back to saying Jesus went out of his way at times to be very particular and very clear and keep it very simple. There's verses that I don't understand in the Bible, and I've studied it for a long time, but these are not absent of clarity. Even in another historical account of Jesus that his friend Matthew wrote, we see that Jesus gets in a conflict with people of a different religious persuasion. They were the Jewish religion of the day, the Pharisees and the scribes and everything else, and he gets into debate with them. And he says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you're hypocrites, for you travel across land and sea to make a single proselyte, a convert to your way of doing religion. And when he becomes a convert, you make him twice as much a child of hell as yourselves." I highlight that because Jesus clearly looked at this and said, your version is wrong. And the version I'm communicating, which is the only version, is right. Now, with that said, I want to be clear. We may not be comfortable with Jesus' exclusive tone here. We may not even agree with Jesus' exclusive tone here. But we can't deny that whatever documentation we have of Jesus, it's in that documentation, right? It's in here. We have to wrestle with it. It's not like it was added in such a way that Jesus didn't maybe really say it or whatever else. We have no evidence of that. It's just, this is the record we have of Jesus. These are the things that Jesus said. And so he was clear. He was tight with that clarity. And I just want to be honest with that. Again, I don't want to sell somebody something that isn't real or half sold, and then down the road you're like, wait a minute, this is stricter than I thought. No, I think it's good to be clear. But also in this, I want to add something. I might be a little feisty here, I know, watch out. But here's the thing. It's what I was saying earlier. Most all religions are exclusive. Non-religion, like I said, is exclusive. When it says all religions are wrong, it's an absolute statement of fact when that statement's made. It's an exclusive idea, right? And to neglect that fact, the idea that all religions are claiming to be the exclusive way and they have a road to this exclusive way, whatever that way ends or however it ends in the end, to not acknowledge that and to not be respecting of that, I believe, is to be intolerant of diversity. I honestly believe that. I think when people say, oh, they all go to the same place in the end. Oh, they're basically the same. Oh, they're all fundamentally equal. They just sound a little different. I go, I think that's intolerant of the fact that that's not what they fundamentally say. Right? Most people that hold deeply to the religious convictions believe that it is the way, which is why they hold to those religious convictions. And it's oftentimes people that may not be as committed to any one thing that are wanting to generalize and throw them all together and say they're basically the same. Now, I would say there's a lot of similarity on the fringes of many different ideas and religions and worldviews in our world, even the non-religious worldviews. We still seem to agree on morality and ethics and basic laws, and, you know, we want better quality of living for humans, and that's all true. But when you get to the deepest essential core of belief and conviction, they're not the same. They're very different. It's like trying to say that, you know, Russell Wilson and Colin Kaepernick, they're basically the same, right? Because they're both quarterbacks. They're both African Americans. They're basically the same. You go, well, they're not basically the same. It's like saying, well, Republicans and Democrats are basically the same. It's all politics. They elect people. Those people vote. It's pretty much the same. See, when we get all down to it, we find that these things are not generally the same. I think it's important to acknowledge that the belief, the deep conviction of a Buddhist is one that there's no transcendent being on the other end. There's just personal enlightenment. You're detaching from the passions and pleasures of this world. You're trying to see yourself get to a point where you've let go of all of the stuff of this world, and from that you can transcend to a higher level in reincarnation. So for them, your primary focus is being unimpassioned, almost having this neutrality about life to find peace. And then from that, you're going to level up in the next life. That is very different than a Muslim that says, I do the five pillars. I labor my whole life in rigid faithfulness. I adopt a culture that is very strict on a number of things. And I hope that Allah shows me mercy in the end and brings me into his bliss. Those are very different. If you tell a Muslim, well, that sounds a lot like somebody that's Jewish. You've just offended the Muslim. Because they look and they go, that's nothing like what is Jewish. And they see the Jews in a completely different light. And if you tell a Jew, well, what you guys believe is really similar to Christians, they're going to be very bothered because they have a big problem with Jesus. Right? And so to just ubiquitize it all and blend it up into one big chunk, again, I think doesn't show respect to diversity. It doesn't show respect to people's deepest convictions. And so, again, I would advocate that we're better off to say, they're not all the same. They're all profoundly different. On the surface, they have some connecting points, but again, a lot of things on the surface have connecting points. And so when Christianity says, hey, it believes it's the only way, it's just because it's in a sea of many other things that say it is the only way. Now, I think part of the challenge in this, or one of the things we struggle with, and this is where I'm going to speak to us as Christians now, is I think sometimes when a group thinks its way is the way, it feels like it needs to emphasize that or drive that in all the spheres of life, right? Like if we're right, then everything we touch, we need to bring our rightness to the table. Now, again, this isn't simply true for Christians. In the Islamic world, there's a strong sense of that as well. In other cultures, there can be a strong sense of that. In regimes that are controlled more by an atheist mindset, there is the sense in which we must enforce and reinforce the atheist mindset within our culture. So again, this can be true to all, but I'm now speaking to my Christian friends here. I want us to understand number three in your notes, that Christianity is not called to be systemically exclusive in every way, right? Not in every way. Here's partly why I'm saying this. I think as Christians, we have to understand that those who are not connected to communities of faith like Christianity, maybe they're very far outside of it, or they've had a very bad experience with it, or whatever else, when they look at kind of this slightly political, religious, evangelical thing that is Christianity, they're a little nervous. I know that might surprise us. It might surprise us because, again, it's what I said before. Sometimes the caricature doesn't match the majority. So I think there's a caricature of Christians that are out there that doesn't match most people that I know as Christians. Like, honestly, I'm like, I've not met that guy, right? But there is a caricature. And from that, there is a fear that what Christians most want, the thing we are voting our way to, the reason we support a certain agenda is because we want this theocracy again. We want to see where the Bible is what the Supreme Court uses in their daily decisions. We want to make sure that everybody is Christianized or somehow you're going to be a lesser citizen. This is the fear that people have. Now, again, I don't think it's something that would be legitimate. It's not the way I know most Christians to think and function and act, but it's a fear that people have, right? But we want to remember that because it can be seen as extreme. The other thing they sometimes look and they go, therefore, it's the mission of Christians to drive out or oppose anything that isn't sort of reminiscent of Christianity. And on this one, I'd say most of the time, no, but in some parts of the country, yes. Right? And this is where we need to be sensitive, right? Because there are times where you'll see Muslims want to build a mosque and it will be the local churches that come against it. Right? Or some group, some atheist group wants to do something and Christian groups will want to protest that because we feel like, no, we have to oppose all others because we're the ones that are right. And I think in reality, Christians should probably approach things a little bit different. Now, you're just getting my opinion at this point, but I'm going to try to subsidize it here in a minute. First of all, I think it's important to acknowledge within a local community the differences as Christians. And I think it's important to, in that, interact with people who hold to these things. That's a part of the diversity fabric of America. If we're going to be a melting pot, we have to kind of melt together a little bit when it comes to our relationships, our conversations, our interactions, even our help toward one another in some way. I think those things are all healthy. I would go a step further, and I know some people are going to maybe disagree with this, but I think it's important for Christians to be more apt to stand up for the rights of other people who may not believe like us or even fully agree with us. I think it's more important to stand up for those rights than to oppose those rights. Because I find that most people, how they come to Christ is not because they're like, oh, wow, I saw this thing on the news about Christians and it wooed me. It's a grassroots campaign where somebody befriended me. And if we want people to look out for our religious rights, we don't want to eventually be opposed for wanting to build a church on 203. We shouldn't be really apt to want to oppose everybody else who wants to do something that we don't agree with. Right? That's part of just being a good neighbor. I think there should be a lot more looking out for it, especially because we live in a culture that affirms people have these rights and they have these freedoms. And I think Christians are at their best when they are encouraging versus discouraging or destructive in those things. And if I want to step deeper, I think it's even important to be willing to share a sense of respect for different people, even if we don't fully agree on everything. So some examples in my mind. Jesus was certainly one of those examples, right? So there's a scene where this woman comes to Jesus and her daughter is having all kinds of problems. And in the story, we learn that she's a Canaanite woman. So it specifically says this, and we may not be familiar with what Canaanites are, but let's just say they were not the most savory bunch of people in the world for Jesus's population. These were outcasts, they were outsiders, they would have been seen as pagan. She would have been seen as pagan because she's called a Canaanite. She worshipped other gods. There would have been a lot of baggage attached to her life. And she comes to Jesus needy, and they have this very weird, interesting interaction. And then Jesus shows this woman great grace and mercy and compassion and brings healing to her daughter. He didn't say, nope, you're a Canaanite, can't help you, right? No, he kind of coaxes this interaction, and from that, man, shows her mercy, helps her out, brings her aid. We see Jesus does this another time with a woman that's said to be a Samaritan woman, and it's at a well. And Samaritans were not the same as Jews, and they even talk about worship. He's like, hey, you guys worship here, and the Jews worship there. Where the Jews worship was the right place to worship. That was the place God prescribed. Where the Samaritans worship was not the place that God in the Old Testament prescribed, and the ways they worship were not the ways that God had prescribed. And yet, Jesus shows this woman tremendous grace and mercy. He interacts with her. He has a relationship with her. And in the context of that relationship, where he's showing her respect where she's at, coaxing out conversation as they go from that, then she's curious. And then she brings other people to Jesus, like, you got to hear this guy. He told me about everything I've ever done and everything else. It's built on relationship and respect. I think about Paul in a historical account called the Book of Acts, where he goes into the city and he sees that they're massively, massively committed to worshiping all kinds of other gods. And he sits down with the Stoic philosophers and he starts to kind of commend them. I see you men are religious in every way. And he builds off of what's familiar to them. He doesn't just scold them right off the bat. He doesn't just violently oppose them right from the get-go or anything like that. No, he interacts, he invests. See, what I find so often is this thing that we sometimes will struggle with as Christians, and it's the idea that coexist bumper sticker is altogether bad. It does not say co-affirm, co-agree. It just basically says get along. And get along is healthy. Get along is the fabric of being a good neighbor. Get along is the fabric of showing kindness and compassion and thoughtfulness to the people around us. The other thing I want to be clear about with Jesus or Paul or any of the New Testament characters that we see is that they did this with a clear objective. And the clear objective was not just, we're all going to go along and get along and that's it. There was a clear objective where they're like, and our heart and hope is to expose others to the hope of Jesus. That's the objective. I want to be clear for anybody watching or listening that may not be a Christian. If they say, so in other words, you have an agenda. Of course. If I didn't believe this was true, how dumb would I be? I want everybody to experience what I've experienced. Of course, there's an agenda, but I go back to everybody has an agenda. The atheist has an agenda. The agnostic does. The Muslim does. The Jewish person, everybody has an agenda. Now we're talking about how authentic the agenda is. In other words, it's not really an agenda as much as a passion. This is my life's been changed. I want you to experience that. And that was true for Paul. That was true for the people that Jesus touched. And I think that's what motivates us as well. I think where we get stuck as Christians is we get concerned that being supportive equals, like, I agree. Right? That if I'm supportive, I endorse. If I defend your right, then it means I think you're right. And I would like to say I don't believe that really necessarily computes. I don't think to defend the right is the same as saying somebody is right. I think about a story again in the life of Jesus where Jesus finds himself in a very weird spot. He finds himself standing between a woman who's been caught in adultery and religious leaders who have a Bible in their hand, right? This is a weird spot for Jesus. He's between these two worlds. And as the story goes, nobody's debating whether the woman is in fact somebody that was just caught in the act of committing adultery. Nobody's disputing that. She was. She isn't denying it. Jesus doesn't deny it. That's her circumstance. And then you have the religious leaders over here with Moses under arm. There's a clear verse from God that deals with her conduct. And then Jesus is standing between the two of them, right? And this is where you see that Jesus is in a mode of defending one, right, who is wrong. According to the book that these guys are holding over here where the book is right, right? Does that mean now that Jesus is saying she's right? No, he never says that. And he knows their heart is wrong, even though their book is right, right? But he gets in the middle of that fray because he's going for something deeper, right? And so he hopes, and then the defense of the woman, it's going to rescue her from her situation, and she will do life differently. So he shields her. And at the same time, he kind of confronts their arrogance with their book under arm and says, come on, you guys, you know you're guilty too. Right? This is the brilliance of Jesus, and I think it highlights the fact that just because we may support or defend people's rights in our society, it does not mean that by the same token we believe they're right. It doesn't have to be like that. There are many people in my life, I defend their right to what they do, but I don't think they're right. But I think they have the right to do it. The other thing I would say is that while everyone has the right to do as they want, not everyone is inherently right, and it is okay to acknowledge that. I'm not trying to roll it all together, right? I support the right of others to be exclusive, to say their way is the velvet rope. And yet equally, I look at my Christian faith and go, man, if I look at all of it and I put it all together, I think it advocates for something that is truly right. And it's okay to acknowledge that. It's okay to say that. It's okay to say that the vision of life that Jesus set out makes life better. And I think there's things to stand behind that to highlight some of that. And so clarity is helpful. Conviction is helpful. And in this, I would say when we're looking at all the options as individuals, if you haven't landed on anything, I think it's really critical then to say, hey, everybody has the right, not everything is right, therefore I will judge things on their merits. I will dig in to see, of all the claims, which one seems to have the most alignment with what I perceive to be rational and I perceive to be real. And so that takes us to number four in your notes. Christianity's exclusivity should be measured on its merits, all right, on its merits. And not just its alleged narrow-mindedness. Because again, that's why it's narrow-minded. Well, sometimes narrow-minded is also right. Right? There's a lot of things in life you go, well, you're just being narrow-minded about gravity. Right. But it's just right. You're not narrow-minded if something's right. And so we should always investigate. All right? And so here's three things I want to say about Christianity. This is just going to go really fast. These are things that I've kind of worked through myself and trying to assess these different things. First is this, Christianity is more culturally accommodating than any other religion or even non-religion. I know some of you are going to be like, no, wait, those missionaries go and they want to change everybody all the time to be just like Western people. No, those are actually fewer and far between and increasingly even less so. What you actually find is the strangest thing. Christianity is truly a global cultural religion. If you look at other religions, by and large, they've kind of stayed in their basic territories of the world. So if you're a Hindu, it's mostly stayed in a territory, Buddhism in a territory, Islam in a territory. Christianity for 2,000 years is just sort of absorbed into all these different environments and cultures. Matter of fact, today, churches are going to gather all over the world in over 2,000 languages, right? That's unique to the Christian faith. What's unique to the Christian faith is if you go to the church in Ethiopia and you watch a worship service, you as an American will be freaked out. Because it's so embedded into what their culture looks like. You go to a Russian church, it's different. You go to an African church, it's different. You go to some of the churches in India or Pakistan, and it's different the way they do it. But there's this centrality of Jesus and the gospel and the cross and the resurrection. And so again, there's a lot of cultural diversity. And it doesn't surprise me because the Bible opens with saying God wants to bless the nations. And it closes with God being celebrated by the nations. In many different languages and all kinds of different tribes and all sorts of different cultural looks. And so I find that Christianity is that thing that while it has a certain set of convictions that are very much velvet rope, there's a lot of the outplay of that that just leaks into culture, is informed by culture. And from that, there's this unique symbiotic relationship between Christ and culture that is different than maybe a lot of other systems. The second thing is that I find that Christianity is more intellectually satisfying than any other religion or even non-religion. I find that kind of pure scientific atheism is not satisfying for the deepest questions of life. It might be satisfying for certain intellectual curiosities and certainly advancement of science and medicine, but there's a lot of deep, deep things that it doesn't solve. And so I find that within this, it's broader. Now, as you all know, I'm a skeptic, right? I've repeatedly mentioned that I struggle with being a skeptic. So when I look at the idea of Christianity, I come with a skeptic mindset. And therefore, for me, it's not like there's this one argument that pushes me over the top. In the same way that in science we have the theory of evolution, which, by the way, that doesn't mean the hypothesis of evolution. A theory in science is a series of disciplines, a number of ideas all pulled together with evidence and information. And then from that you go, here's a cogent big picture of that. This is why it's not, music theory is not a guess. Music theory is this series of things that you learn to produce music, right? Atomic theory is not a guess about nuclear reactors. No, it's a series of disciplines that pull together. So I believe in a theory of Christianity. In other words, by that I'm saying, I look at things like, okay, how the cosmos was formed. And I go, man, there's too much luck in there to get what we have today. That sinks in. I look at biology, too much complexity in the cell and DNA and everything else to say that just was luck and that just happened. And then I look at morality and how we all seem to share it globally and that wouldn't have just been luck. And then I look at deeper things like when the Bible prescribes ideas for marriage, I find those to be the healthiest marriages when people follow that prescription. When I look at the best way of living my own personal life, when I live by the Bible, life is healthier. And so I look at this whole aggregate, all the different pieces, and I go, man, when I put it all together, that is the most satisfying. That checks the majority of those boxes more than any other thing checks all those boxes. So it's not one box or two boxes for me. It's probably dozens and dozens of boxes, but I find that it is the most stimulating. It holds up the best when I pull all those pieces together. But then the last thing is that I find that Christianity is universally unique to any other religion or non-religion. Here's what I'm getting at. The velvet rope. If we compared all the systems, one day we're trying to figure out how we get past the velvet rope into whatever's next. Heaven, nirvana, whatever it is. There's always going to be that ultimate question, right? Somebody at the velvet rope saying, all right, what's the secret password? What's the thing? What did you do? How do you get the access? Because I'm ready to pull. I'm ready to open this up for you and bring you in. But what gets you through? Right? And so the atheist says, well, information, knowledge, at least is in this life, gets me through. I listen every week to at least two atheist podcasts that I really enjoy, and what's true to atheism is what it most celebrates. The thing that saves you in atheism is what you know. They don't like ignorant people. You must learn more. You must be knowledgeable. Anybody that may sound ignorant, it's not as worthy. So it's going to be information. For the Buddhist, they'll say, well, did you let go of life? Did you have no passions and no pleasures and you came to the state of nothing moves you emotionally? If so, you can bump up to the next level. So did you grow in enlightenment versus did you grow in intellect? The Muslim will say, well, I did the five pillars And I was loyal and I was dedicated. I think about a Muslim friend I asked her one time. I said, do you feel loved by Allah? And she physically stepped back and she goes, no, Allah does not love us. We hope that only in the end he shows us mercy because we worked hard. So the question for the Muslim is, but did you follow all the statutes and standards and rules and regulations? And by chance, did you get lucky enough for mercy? Right? For the Jew, did you follow the Old Testament law? There's a lot in there, 613 commands. Did you do them? That's the question. Right? And so on and on we could go through this whole thing, right? And that's going to be the fundamental thing. Every one of these things go, here's the way to enter into the VIP space. What did you do? Christianity is the only one that when you get here, the question is not what did you do? It's who did you believe? And the way we get through, the way we pass is not by our effort, our enlightenment, our information, our knowledge, our letting go of this world. It's not by keeping 613 rules or anything else. It's simply this crazy notion that says, I couldn't earn, I couldn't achieve, I couldn't do, I was broken, I knew it. I had all this stuff and baggage in my life, and I threw myself completely on the mercy of the grace of Jesus. And they go, that's the answer. In other words, what makes Christianity different than every other system is grace. You don't earn. You don't achieve. There is no check mark of what you do, which is the biggest draw for people. Because when they're asked this question on the street, why would God let you into his heaven? They always say, because I was a fill in the blank. Because I was. See, Christianity says, no. It's because he did. He earned. That being Jesus did it for us. See, that's the difference. John 1:1 says, in the beginning, the Word was with God, and the Word was God. This word, in its original language that the New Testament was written in, is the word logos. It means reason or logic, knowledge, perfect logic and perfect reason existed in the beginning. But this perfect reason, in verse 14, became flesh, became a person, and he dwelt among us. And we have seen his glory, the glory as the only Son from the Father, and he is full of grace, and he is full of truth. So in our system, what's unique is God becomes a person, and in his perfection and in his perfect reason, he gives himself fully to us, and he gives himself fully for us. And in that, he doesn't rescue us because of everything that we do. Rather, he rescues only in his grace given to us. But in that grace, he also gives us truth. And he doesn't give us the truth so we can earn coming through the rope. He gives us truth so he can bless us for life. This book is not meant to wreck your life. It's meant to unleash the fullness of your life. And it all flows again from grace. Verse 16 says, for from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. When somebody says, not Christianity is the same as all others, the one thing we should have clearly in our mind is to say, no, but I can tell you where it's different. I can tell you where it's different. It's grace. And what I would add to in this as I kind of wrap up right now is this. We and our tone should be known by that same grace. I've said before, grace is our brand. Grace is the rescuer. Grace is the thing that says, you can enter. And if that's the main thing, then more than anything that our culture needs to see is people that embody, live, have the tone of that grace. Jesus doesn't say submit or die. Jesus is actually saying surrender and live. And that's what he offers in his grace. Let's go ahead and pray together. Jesus, I thank you for your grace, your wisdom, and your reminder. I thank you for the fact that we can deal with hard questions and hard things. And I pray in that, with our deepest convictions, we'll still have deep grace for people. That this is not arrogant or proud or obnoxious. But rather, we will almost like quake at our knees to think that you've been so kind to us and you don't count our lives against us because we do many things that we know are not the best. And yet you rescue in grace. Thank you for this distinctive given to us in your name. Amen.